Welcome to Everything Co-op, bringing you information on how cooperatives can help improve your quality of life. This show is being sponsored by the National Co-op Bank, NCB. The NCB is dedicated to strengthening communities nationwide for the delivery of banking and financial services for the nation's cooperatives, their members, and other socially responsible organizations. For more information on the power of community ownership, visit ncb.coop. That's ncb.coop. Now stay tuned for your host, Vernon Oakes.
Good morning, everybody. This is Vernon Oakes, and the program is Everything Co-op. This morning, we have the pleasure of talking to Malik Yakini and Lene Gilbert-Williams. Both are Detroiters. Good morning.
Good morning.
Peace, peace.
So we're talking about the Detroit People's Food Co-op. Malik, when is that going to open?
I'm going to bounce that to Lene.
Lene?
The co-op is due to open on May 1st.
May 1st.
How exciting. A May 1st opening with a May 18th celebration.
May 1st opening, and when is the celebration?
May 18th.
Okay, well, I want to come to the celebration.
Come on now.
Okay. All right, so now, Malik, how long did it take from idea to get this started?
I guess the idea started in February 2006 at the founding meeting of the Detroit Black Community, at that time Food Security Network. Then the idea took a little more shape in 2009 when we started the Ujamaa Food Co-op Buying Club, which was a monthly buying club intended to be the precursor to the brick and mortar store that has become Detroit People's Food Co-op. And then we've been working on the brick and mortar store every day since 2010.
Every day since 2010. That's 14 years?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Okay.
It's been a journey.
It's been a journey.
Yes.
We want to talk a little bit about that journey. But in that journey, how much money did you have to raise to get the brick and mortar up?
The project itself, which, by the way, the brick and mortar is called the Detroit Food Commons, and it was built for the Detroit People's Food Co-op, and the Detroit People's Food Co-op is the anchor tenant, but the whole building is called the Detroit Food Commons, and the whole building costs close to $22 million.
Fantastic. 13 years, $22 million. Every day for 13 years.
Well, 14
now. Okay. Okay. And I'm sure everything went smoothly.
Like all things, you know, there are smooth parts of the road and there's parts of the road that have potholes and bumps and all those kind of things.
Yes. Lene has this huge smile on, so I guess she's been through some of the potholes too. Okay. And the smooth parts.
I've heard about them.
You've heard about them? So how long have you been involved with the Detroit People's Food Co-op, Lene?
Been a member owner since around 2014. I know I got my certificate around 2016, 2017, when all the certificates went out. I've been on a board since 2022, I believe it is, 2021, 2022.
So what is a member owner? You said you were a member owner. What is that?
A member owner is a member of the community who has chosen to be one of the owners of this grocery store. All of the member owners collectively own it. So they pay a one-time, a lifetime membership fee and gain the opportunity to assist in governing this business. So joining a committee, joining the board, just volunteering their skills, their knowledge, their time to ensuring that this co-op becomes all that the member owners as a collective would like it to be.
So you became a member owner in 2014, 10 years ago. You're yes. now the president of the board. What was that journey like from member to president of the board?
You know, for a while, I believe I felt like many member owners, it's already on the road to opening. You know, there are a lot of people involved who's been involved for a long time, and they know what needs to be known. And I don't, you know, I felt like that for a long time. It felt like, you know, I'd have to research for a long time to really understand the movement of Black food sovereignty and, you know, quote unquote, food justice and all the connections that's needed to build a co-op. And it seems like so many people are already involved that know those things. So for quite a while, I was a member owner receiving the newsletters. I wasn't even reading through all of the newsletters. Mm-hmm. I had the belief that I wouldn't understand half of what's said anyway. I was looking for words and concepts that were familiar with me, how close the building is to opening, and maybe some of the people that's involved, things like that. And then a year hit where I said, you know what, I keep getting the newsletters and I'm a part of this, and I would like to prioritize time to assist in whatever way that I can. So I began to actually read through the newsletters and look for ways to help and, you know, determine how much time I had to set aside, maybe 2 hours a week. You know, I'm sure I can set aside, you know, that much time to do whatever is needed. And so I learned about the committee, joined the membership and outreach committee. From the membership and outreach committee, while I was a member of the membership and outreach committee, a board position became available, and the chair encouraged me to run for the board position.
So membership and outreach committee. So you joined a committee to get more members in. How many members do you have now?
We have a little over 2,500.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Because I've heard a magic number of 2,000 that you need.
That was the goal.
Yes.
It was the goal before opening. So we've exceeded that goal.
Okay. And is that because of the membership committee?
Greatly in part of the membership committee. And word of mouth seems to be the greatest way to get the information about the co-op out there. Our first press release went out at the beginning of this year. So we're just now really getting out there heavily in the media. And of course, that's bringing in a wave of member owners, but a lot of it was word of mouth. I know that, you know, we have something in the co-op called the Malik effect.
The Malik effect.
Uh-huh. He goes out and he's talking about the co-op and talking about Black food sovereignty and the work that the Detroit Black Community Food Sovereignty does. And that tends to bring a wave of member owners. So I'm sure that was going on for quite a while. So, just with all the people involved, really spreading the word and talking to people that they know about the co-op.
And when Malik goes out, there's the Malik effect. You get more and more people to come in. What is the membership fee?
$200.
One time?
One time, $200. It can also be paid on a payment plan, $20 a month. For 10 months.
Okay.
And we're working on scholarships right now that will cover half of the fee and determining how those scholarships should go out.
Okay. So I'm going to do my very best to be there May 18th. That's when you said the party is, right? Okay.
That's right. The party's on May 18th. May 1st is when the Detroit Food Commons, the entire building, so the co-op on the first floor, the Detroit Black Community Food Sovereignty Networks, commercial kitchens, the Kuji Chagalia commercial kitchens upstairs, the Mama Imani Humphrey Hall, so this grand meeting space upstairs, And the office spaces, the entire building opens on May 1st, but the party's on the 18th.
Okay. Party's what I want to come to. You going to have good music and dancing? Or y'all just going to eat?
You better.
Okay.
There's a whole committee for it.
So my brother raised his family in Detroit. And so when I come up, I'm going to invite all four of his children and their children and see if they'll become members. There's probably 25, 30 people in the Klan. But we'll see if they will join.
Bring them.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Is the Food Commons, is it close to Motown?
Probably about maybe a mile and a half from Motown.
So I asked that. I knew it was fairly close. And what's the boulevard or street that it's on?
We're on Woodward Avenue, which is the main street of Detroit at Euclid, East Euclid.
Okay, I'm going to see if I can get the Malik Effect going, too, to see if I can get some members. Okay. Malik, I may need a call on you to come out and do your magic with my family peoples. Okay. So, Malik, you've been there since the beginning. How has it been for you? And how do you feel that it's opening?
I'll start with the second question. Of course, I'm happy after working on this for 14 years to see it open. But also, as I've shared with Lene, although I'm happy to see it open, it's kind of a shame that it's such a big thing that Black people are leading the opening of a grocery store. It should be the normal thing. You know, this should be what's happening in Black communities throughout the country. So on one level, yes, I'm very happy. I'm excited. We're going to open. But the reason for doing this is to try to transform our people. And so in the big scheme of things, this is a drop in the bucket. It's a significant drop because it's a model of what can be done, but we have a much larger work to do. So I'm really, you know, always focused on what is the larger work. You know, yes, this is an important milestone that can lead us to the larger work, but we still have a tremendous job to do to extract our people from the grips of capitalist exploitation.
The grips of capitalist exploitation.
Yeah, let me add another adjective. Capitalist white supremacist exploitation.
Yes.
In case people have any lack of clarity about what I'm talking about. So, I mean, and what's happening in Detroit is what happens in Black communities throughout the country, which is that other ethnic groups come into our community and control all of the grocery stores. So in Detroit, that ethnic group happens to be Chaldeans, an ethnic minority from Iraq, who has a long history of entrepreneurship, and they're a Christian minority in a Muslim majority country. They've been in the Detroit area for the last, in relatively large numbers, for the last 120 years or so, and have had this history of entrepreneurship. So I'm not really mad at Chaldeans per se, but I'm mad at exploitation of Black people. If you go to Chicago, it's not going to be Chaldeans. It's going to be another ethnic group. If you go to L.A., it's going to be another ethnic group. So that the ethnicities change, but the scenario of Black people being the doormat of humanity and of other people coming in and taking advantage of the disempowerment which has occurred in Black communities and finding ways to then become the extractors of wealth from our communities. So if we want to be self-determining, self-reliant, and free, we've got to figure out a way to stop the economic bleeding in our community. So, yes, I'm very happy about the opening of the Detroit People's Food Co-op and looking forward to this larger work that we have to do.
Okay. I got the larger work, whether it's food co-ops or housing co-ops or worker-owned co-ops, is getting Blacks, brown, indigenous people to own their business, own their labor, rent the capital. And it's sad when you come out of Detroit or the Rust Belt and see how there's buildings in Detroit. I worked at Dearborn in 1968, maybe. No, it was 1966. I was just out of high school. And there were some of the guys on the line, the brothers took me to their houses, and they told me, go get an education. Do not stay on this line. The money was good. But when I would go back there and visit my brother and his family, those houses that I would have given a left arm for in 65, 66, 68, they're just in really bad shape, terrible shape. So, and I've been around this white supremacy, white capitalism, where they extract, because I grew up in West Virginia, and they would come out, they would come in and extract the land, take out the coal, leave the land in really bad shape, the water in bad shape, and they left the people broken and in bad shape, because they would take their pensions. So yeah, this capitalism is terrible. And that's why I am extremely excited about you all opening food commons in Detroit. And we'll do everything I can. I think I'm a member. I think I joined the first time we were on the air, Malik. I think I joined. So what are some of the different issues that you all have had? Linnea, I would like for you to go. What are some of the different kinds of things that you've had to go through?
I can only speak from just in recent years with the co-op, again, and being on a board, because before that I was on a membership and outreach committee. But I can tell you that one of the issues that we're facing still is that many Detroiters have no idea what a co-op is. I'm still having member owners to ask me, but who owns it? Like, really, who owns it? As if there's a person at the top who owns it. I've seen some comments on social media posts where some people believe that the government owns it. Because we're saying no one in particular owns it. Because the concept of no one person owning a company, a business in Detroit, is not commonplace. So having to consistently say to member owners that they own the co-op, and not really getting to say all that I could say about a co-op and the solutions that the co-op brings, which I do, I find that one of the greatest obstacles is really getting people to understand that member owners govern the co-op, and that they have a say, that they can come to every board meeting because they've elected their board members to assist in governing the co-op, that they should be at the different meetings and listening to the reports and different things like that. So that's an obstacle.
Well, that's why we started this show 10 years ago, 10 and a half years ago now, was because people don't know what a co-op is, and the idea is to give them information and stories so they'll know what a co-op is and want to either start one or join one so that they can do like you did, Lene, and that is get in and run it, get on the board. And the board then sets policies and operate it. So I have it that the co-op is owned by those 2,500 members. That's what I have, those members.
That's right.
Member owners. Okay. You said that this is black-led and community-owned, Malik. What do you mean by that?
So, as I mentioned, this was initiated by the Detroit Black Community Food Sovereignty Network. We initiated it with the expressed intent of uplifting the black community. But we also realize it functioning within American society that you can't start a business and kind of legally operate and say it's only black people. And so on the on the advice of our attorneys, you know, anyone who's a Michigan resident can join. And so that means that we have member owners who are not black. And so when we say black led and community owned, we want to make that distinction that the leadership, the people driving the co-op, making the decisions, are black, and we are committed to black leadership in all that we do, both in the organization of the co-op organization, you know, the board and the people who are making decisions, but also now within the store, the general manager and the two department managers that we've hired are black as well. So we're committed to black leadership, but we have a membership that includes people who are not black.
Okay, so you have a general store manager that's black, and you have two departments. What departments are those?
We have what we're calling the fresh departments, which is actually a combination of the produce department and the kind of dairy, eggs section. And then we have what's called the center store manager, who deals with all the things in the aisles as well as the frozen foods. We were looking for a prepared foods department manager. Also, we haven't been able to find a person that we could come to an agreement on yet. And so in the interim, the general manager, Akil Talley, is going to also serve as the prepared food section manager.
So that prepared food is with sandwiches?
We have a complete kitchen and deli area in the co-op. And so we'll have soups. We'll have soups and other hot foods. We'll have sandwiches and salads, various grab-and-go items, coffee, various cold beverages. So people, if they want to run in there and be able to get lunch, they'll be able to get either a hot or cold lunch and something to drink. And, you know, if they want dessert, we'll have that. Or if people want to grab a bottle of wine on the way home in the evening, we'll have that as well.
All right. So I've talked to you about some of the problems you've had. What are some of the smooth spots? Malik, I'd ask you that one.
Well, first of all, I want to say the whole process is miraculous. And if this were easy, it would have been done many times in black communities throughout the United States. So we're hoping that by us creating this model, we ease the way for people who are doing this in the future. But it's miraculous in that we have a variety of viewpoints among the key leaders of the co-op. And that would include the board, the committee heads, and the most active members. We have a diversity of viewpoints. And often having an organization that has a diversity of viewpoints can end up with that organization imploding. We have been able to create a container where people can have their views, and we are still able to synthesize those views and move forward collectively without any major cleavage in the co-op. You know, we haven't had a group of member owners say, we're going to pull out because we don't like this decision. That we've been able to keep it intact. So that in itself is miraculous, and I want to really lift that up. The other thing is that it's an example of the longevity and fortitude that is necessary to build black institutions. As we noted in the beginning of the conversation, it's taken us 14 years of daily work to get to this point. And often within our community, we're conditioned to respond to short-term issues. If the police kill a black person, we run out in the streets and protest, as we rightfully should. But typically those protests last a month, 6 weeks, maybe 2 months, and then they peter out. And then white supremacy continues unabated, business as usual for the most part. So we're conditioned to responding to things in the short term. We're not conditioned to the long-term commitment that it takes for institution building, ultimately nation building. And so that's another, I think, miraculous part of this process that we want to lift up, that there's a need for stick-to-itiveness and longevity if we're serious about building the kind of institutions that create healthy communities.
Stick-to-itiveness. How many people, Malik, have stuck all of this time?
Since day one? There's probably a group of 10 or less of us who've been there from the very beginning.
Well, I think that's great that you've had 10. That's probably maybe been 20, 30, 40, 50 that the people leave out. But I think it's great that you've had 10. We're going to take our first break, and then we're going to come back And I want to talk more about Maliki hitting on this co-op and what it means for the black community, creating wealth, decision making, creating self-worth, all of us in our community. We'll be right back. Please don't touch that dial.
News Talk 1450 WOL AM, where information is power.
Everything Co-op. As I said earlier, we've been on the air for 10 and a half years, and the National Cooperative Bank has been our main financial supporter for those 10 and a half years. So I just want to give a shout out to them. They've been great partners. And their mission is to help co-ops and their members by providing innovative financial services, and particularly in low-income communities. And that's hard for most bank or most financial institutions to do. Okay. Lene, I want to start with you. You said that you joined and you would get the newsletters. You would read through whatever you liked or saw, and then you would put it away. And then at one point you said, I would spend 2 hours a week. Okay. Now, so you have 6 kids and a job. All right. How could you even get 2 hours? And I assume you spend a lot more than 2 hours now that you were on the membership committee and the board president.
Yeah. So it was around a time where I was just really aware of the fact that, like our dollars, we have to, prioritize where we utilize our time. You know, we spend time on social media or on doing other things that is not productive as we consider productive to be. And I was already thinking, you know, I want to do some more things in the community. I've been working in the community for a very long time. I want to do some things in the community. I want to do some more things in the community. And at first didn't feel like, you know, really want to take on anything heavy, but the beauty of consistently receiving these newsletters was that it reminded me I'm already involved in something else in the committee. I just have not been prioritizing time for it. Mm-hmm. Let me, work on finishing what I started, or at least engaging and becoming involved in something I'd already committed to. I was at the time willing to, you know, do the easiest thing. I'm just going to give my money and then they got it.
Good. Yep.
It's just going to come up, you know? But it was like, hey, let me set aside some time to assist the process. Since I'm saying I want to, you know, do a bit more in the community, and it's turned out to be that and then some.
So how many hours do you say you spend now in a week?
I have no idea. Detroit People's Food Co-op, I always joke that this board just does not shut down. Hmm. All the different members say that they, you know, set aside time to answer emails, text messages, phone calls. Every single day this board is on. Every single day we're emailing each other throughout the day, or texting, or calling. We have a good group of people who are really dedicated to the mission of the co-op, and really, like, you know, I don't know what it is being around the other people that's involved in the co-op, but it's a group of people who just don't turn off.
So, Lene, the group don't turn off. They're a good group of people. They work every day. Okay.
Every day.
So, looking over your resume, I don't see anywhere where you have a business degree, or where you have learned how to run a grocery store, a food co-op. How do you get the knowledge to be a board president and to learn about this business?
Have a willingness to connect with and learn from other people. I am a person who has always loved connecting with other people, and I love to learn. As a mother, it is very, very, very important to me to model a life that I would like for my children to live. And so I would like for my children to play a role in solutions in their community. I would like for them to know and to see how great a people we are. I would like for them to know and see the beauty of us coming together. And so I have to model that. I have to do that. They have to see it in real time, not read it in a book back in history and feel like that was forever ago, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you make the time.
You make the time.
This is just a part of living. This is me mothering. This is what my motherhood looks like. Okay. And so I've listened to people in the community. I've been asking. Baba Malik was one I asked many years ago as a stay-at-home mom and as a homeschooling mom. I was asking, hey, you know, I want to do some things in the community. What do you think? You know, what does the community really, really need? You know, just seeking wisdom. And one of the things that he said is, you know, you really got to keep your ears to the streets. You got to keep a pulse on what's going on, because you can see an issue, create a solution. It will take decades to implement that solution. And by the time the solution has come about, the problem is no longer the same. So you have to be willing to pay attention to what's going on at all times, and evolve and learn what's needed at any given moment. That was really, really big for me. So I just set out to find issues that I could either create a solution to or partner with others to create a solution to. So Detroit People's Food Co-op is one of those things that I've come across.
Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. You also have a 7.5-acre farm, Malik?
Yeah, so we changed the name of our organization last September to the Detroit Black Community Food Sovereignty Network. And I wanted, if I can take just a minute to explain why we changed our name. When we started in 2006, we were familiar with this term food security, which is becoming popularized throughout the United States. And in time, we realized that really the work we're doing, it was food sovereignty work. And I'll distinguish between the two. Food security basically means, or community food security means, that all the members of a community have adequate amounts of food each day, that people are not hungry, that they have the calories that they need to go about their day-to-day business. And while that is certainly an honorable goal, it's a very low bar in a country as wealthy as the United States of America. And then also one of my friends, Raj Patel, once said to me, you can have food security in prison. So you can get three meals a day and have adequate calories potentially in prison. So clearly what we're striving for is something more than people just having adequate calories. And that's something more that we're striving for is what's called food sovereignty. Our work, the work of the Detroit Black Community Food Sovereignty Network, is rooted in the Black Liberation Movement. I want to make that very clear. We are not a reformist group that thinks that just by electing Heckel or Jekyll, that the condition of Black people is going to be significantly better. We are in favor of Black people being able to govern ourselves and creating systems that allow us to use our intellectual property, our physical labor, and the wealth that we generate for our own benefit. And that is certainly not the case for our people now. So food sovereignty really means that the people who are producing and consuming the food shape and define the food system that produces the food they're consuming. And that includes everything from determining first our relationship with the earth. And if you look at traditional African or other indigenous systems of farming, they held the earth as being sacred, as opposed to this kind of capitalistic, white supremacist, Eurocentric approach to farming which sees the earth as just a commodity that we extract wealth from. That's the start of food sovereignty, how we define our relationship to the earth. Food sovereignty also has to do with the type of seeds that we plant. What are we growing and what are the types of seeds that we're going to grow it with? Food sovereignty defines the farming methods that we use. Are we using ecologically friendly earth renewing methods, or are we using the kind of methods that industrial farming uses that strips the nutrients from the earth, strips the topsoil, ruins the topsoil, puts chemical fertilizers and pesticides into the water systems? And then finally, and there's other aspects to defining the food system, but one of the other ones that we find to be extremely important, and I would like to think that we've contributed to this discussion on broadening the definition of food sovereignty, is that the people who are consuming and producing the food also need to have economic benefit, that we're not just satisfied with having enough food in our community, right? Because if that were the only objective, then we would be jumping up and down. If a Walmart wants to move into a black community, that could provide greater access to food. But as a people, we have no greater say-so over our destiny. And the only thing we're able to do is go into a store owned by somebody else and give them our money in exchange for some goods. And so I just want to clarify the difference in food security and food sovereignty.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So the 7.5 acres, you all farm it. Will you be selling what you produce in the store?
Yes. So part of what we've been trying to do at Detroit Black Community Food Sovereignty Network is to create a model of what a closed loop food economy might look like. In fact, we use the term developed or used by the National Black Food and Justice Alliance. We're developing self-determining food economies. Food economies that we are generating from within inside of our own community, circulating the wealth within inside of our own community. So yes, we've been doing farming at our current location since 2008. And the goal was always to connect the farming with the retail side of the food business. But I want to point out, it's not just D-Town Farm, the farm operated by the Detroit Black Community Food Sovereignty Network. We are also prioritizing working with other black farmers in the city. We're interested in the ecosystem of black farmers, not just D-Town Farm, since that's the one that we operate. In fact, we realize that one of the strengths in Detroit is this collective work that takes place both within sectors, like within the farming sector, and across sectors, like between the co-op sector and the farming sector. There's a lot of cross collaboration and a lot of working together. And so it's not about lifting up any one organization or the other. It's about lifting the whole ecosystem so that we're all benefiting from it.
Do you have any sense in your budgeting of what the members may get in terms of how long would it be before you have a surplus or a profit, and what that dividend might look like for your members?
So according to the pro forma projections, we're several years out from that. I'll say that. But I'll also say that people who develop pro formas and accountants are naturally conservative, as they should be. They always err on the side of caution. So they always have very low projections. And so based on their projections, it'll be several years before we turn a profit. But I'm tending to lean more towards the affirmation I've heard from our general manager, Akil Talley, which is, to quote him, "We go blow the numbers out the water."
Uh-oh. Okay.
And let me say this. This is not just based on pulling something out of the sky. We can point to the concrete example of the Detroit Whole Foods Market that opened in 2013. And at the time it opened, there was a lot of skepticism about whether a healthy food-oriented store could do well in a place like Detroit, which is majority black, majority low and moderate income residents. And Whole Foods Corporation, which has great experience in opening multiple stores throughout the world, projected that this store would make a certain amount of money in its first 4 years. And as it turned out, the store made more money in the first year than they projected making in 4 years. And it's turned out to be, per square foot, the best performing store, I'm told, in the Whole Foods chain. So there's always a lot of assumptions about Detroit that tend to diminish us. And, you know, the history has proven that the reality is more robust than some of these projections.
All right. I want to see you all blow those numbers out the water. All right. All right. With the Malik factor and the Lene factor, you said that you had your first press release at the beginning of this year. What other promotions are you doing?
The Membership and Outreach Committee goes out and promotes the co-op and promotes the opportunities for member ownership. So they'll set up tables at local events with information about the co-op, can assist the community in signing up for a membership. We also go out. We're invited to speak about the co-op in different places. And so that's one of the things that we do. We also have...
What's the name of the artist in Detroit?
We've been contacted by a sports player who's interested in helping to get the word out. And hopefully that's the first of many. Detroit is a really large city. There are still people in the city who have no idea that a co-op is coming to the city, who's never heard of Detroit People's Food Co-op. And so any way that we can get the word out, but right now it's really just, for the most part, attending local events, having tables at local events. And now that we have a fully functioning communications committee, they're consistently churning out press releases to update the community on what we're doing.
If I can just add to what Lene said, we've also done a tremendous amount with social media. And in fact, I think that probably has been our primary means of reaching people.
Thanks for reminder.
I thought you were too old, Malik, to do social media. Me and you, not Lene, but me and you.
I surround myself by young people who help me to stay current.
Okay. He does social media better than I do.
So speaking of young people, you have three children, all grown. Are they in the co-op? Are they in the co-op movement, the farming movement? Are you a father like Lene just described her, what her motherhood looks like?
Well, my fatherhood is probably a little different than Lene's motherhood because my children are around Lene's age. And so I don't have little bitty ones that I have to take to school and, you know, make sure they have lunch. I'm past that phase of my parenting.
Mm-hmm.
So my two oldest children, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure whose members are not. I do know one of the gatherings we had a few months ago, and Lene, I'm forgetting which event that was, but in maybe March, maybe January, February, we had something over at Vanguard, and both of my two older children came. I'm not positive whether or not they joined or not, but they did come to the event and they are supportive. And if they haven't joined, I'm sure they will be. I'll be twisting their arms soon if they haven't joined.
Okay. What about farming?
They're not too much into that. So I mentioned we have this family compound we're developing and we have gardens. And frankly, my daughter is the one of my three who most resonates with the, you know, agriculture work. And so she comes by every week and helps. My two sons are not quite as, they don't find it quite as inviting. I'll put it like that. I'm able to drag them out sometimes and get them to help, you know, plant something or dig something up. But they're not nearly as enthusiastic as my daughter.
So urban gardening, do you have a lot of urban gardening, or could you see where you could help create more urban gardening where that food could also come through the food co-op?
So Detroit is currently, I would say, the capital of urban agriculture in the United States.
Wow.
We have more gardens than any other city in the United States. And that's for a variety of reasons. One, going back as far as the 1890s, there was a mayor named Hazen Pingree who sometimes is called Hazen Potato Patch Pingree, because this there was an economic downturn at that time, and he convinced wealthy landowners to share their land with landless people to stave off starvation. Then beginning in the 1920s through the late 1950s, we had the Great Migration with tens of thousands of people coming up from the South, bringing their agricultural knowledge and practice with them. And so, for example, my grandfather on my father's side came from Columbus, Georgia, and brought that with him. And so all of my childhood, he always had a garden in his backyard because that's part of what went with Southern life. And then in the 1970s, we had Mayor Coleman Young, Detroit's first black mayor, who created a program called the Farm-A-Lot program that gave seeds and compost and transplants to residents and let them use tractors and tillers to create gardens on vacant lots. So Detroit has that strong foundation that the current urban agricultural movement is based on. And then we also have a tremendous amount of vacant land in the city of Detroit because of basically because of white flight. That's what we used to call it, at least in the 60s and 70s, white people who began leaving Detroit in the late 1950s as Detroit became increasingly black. And then that exodus reached a fever storm in 1967 after the rebellion. And in the 6 months after the 1967 rebellion, something like 80,000 people left Detroit. And the next year, something like another 70,000 people left. And the next year, 50,000 or so left. So just in a 3-year period, Detroit lost hundreds of thousands of people. And so that's largely, not entirely, but largely due to race. And so Detroit has more vacant land than most places have. And it gives us the opportunity to do urban agriculture on a scale that is not possible in most cities.
Do you all have greenhouses?
We have many farms that have what we call hoop houses.
Hoop houses.
Which are, sometimes we call them also passive solar greenhouses. They're made out with a plastic sheeting over over a frame. A greenhouse technically is a glass structure and it's a permanent structure. So we don't have a lot of glass greenhouses, but many farms in Detroit have hoop houses, which are used to extend the growing season.
So Malik, no, let's go Lene first. I want to ask both of you this question. What have you learned in this process that you'd like to pass to other people?
I've learned. Well, I like when already when people come together, but I've learned just how much people can do when they come together. And as diverse as Detroit is, it's very segregated. Where, you know, whole communities don't really cross each other and don't have to. I have learned with all of these member owners from different ethnic backgrounds that if you give a lot of people a common focus, they're more than willing to come together. It gives them a reason to come together. I've learned that people want to come together and are just not always sure how to.
Okay. So the training you've had, and I'm going to come back to you, Malik, with that same question. Do you see training happening every year to eternity that you all will keep training?
Absolutely. By training, you mean training like board members or leaders? Tell me what you mean by training.
Well, you got the whole members to train about what a co-op is and how it functions.
Right.
And
it'll be forever.
And you can train them in how committees function, how the board functions, and encourage people to come on and start like you did. Two hours a week.
Yeah. Absolutely. I can see training going on forever. It's really encouraging and inspiring other community members to own their power. You know, that's really what it comes down to. We can call it a training and we can teach the ins and outs, but it would really be an encouragement and inspiration sessions to say, hey, you know enough where you are to add on to this, and we can show you how to translate and transfer the skills that you have and what it is that you know into doing work like this, and then create other types of co-ops, not just food co-ops. I think this training will always be needed. It should forever go on.
Thank you. Thank you. Malik, what have you learned that you'd like to pass on? And you will have the last word.
So I've learned several things. One, I've learned some things about confidence. In fact, the Honorable Marcus Garvey said, if you have no confidence, you're twice defeated in the race of life. And so I'm not Christian, but many of my Christian friends like to say, claim the victory. And so having this confidence in, first of all, our own divinity, I would suggest that one of the major problems that Black people are faced with is that the system of white supremacy has somehow convinced us that white people are closer to God, if you want to use that term, God, right? That Black people are somehow, even, you know, this whole mythology about, you know, the sons of Noah and, you know, Black people being cursed, all this stuff is in the back of our minds. When Black people, if you ask a Black person, close your eyes and picture Jesus, they're going to invariably see a white dude with blonde hair, blue eyes, and some white robe on. We've been deeply, deeply, deeply conditioned to believe that there's something more divine about whiteness. And so one of the first things that we have to do as a people is we have to reclaim our own connection to the divine.
Okay, we're going to stop right there. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next Thursday. Live cooperatively.
The preceding program was paid for by Everything Co-op.